Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. And the House of Representatives starts debate today on the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan with a final vote expected tomorrow. We have Congresswomen Catherine Clark and Lori Trahan live on the line with us to talk about it. Congresswomen, it is great to have you both. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be with you.
It's great to have you. Congresswoman Clark, I'll start with you. The vote is expected tomorrow. Speaker Pelosi has said it will pass. Are you expecting any speed bumps?
I am not, and I can tell you that I am so excited to cast a vote for this bill that is going to be transformative, not only meet the immediate challenges we are facing in this country, but be a huge step forward in building back an economy that is even more inclusive. And it couldn't be more important in Women's History Month and yesterday being International Women's Day to have a bill that recognizes how much women have lost in this pandemic and puts the solutions back in place to bring them back to economic health. So it is going to be a very historical and a real cause for optimism when we pass this bill tomorrow.
I am looking forward to diving in with the both of you a little bit more on the provisions for women in the bill as well. Before we do, I just want to turn to you, Congresswoman Trahan, for a minute and just ask you, are you satisfied with the bill as it has come back to the House? And are you feeling good about casting a vote to support it?
Oh, I am as proud as the Assistant Speaker just conveyed to pass this significant piece of legislation. This is a historic package. Working families are going to be able to keep a roof over their heads, put food on the table. Tens of millions of Americans will gain access to vaccines in the coming weeks. Our small businesses and our restaurants will get the help that they need to keep their doors open. And one that I feel so strongly about is our children and educators will return to the classroom safely. So it's not a coincidence that economists, public health experts, Democratic, Republican, and independent state and local officials have come out in support of the American Rescue Plan. It's going to shave an entire year off our projected return to full employment and mitigate millions of job lost this year alone. So I can't wait to vote on the bill.
So it's interesting. I am hearing genuine enthusiasm from the both of you. I mean, obviously, if it's a bill you support, you'll say you support it. But there's something different that I'm hearing here. And at the risk of creating kind of a free-for-all by inviting you both to talk kind of as you see fit going forward here, what does have you so jazzed, especially in terms of what this bill could do for women?
You know, when I ran for Congress, I ran to do good things for women and for children across the Commonwealth, in my district, and across the country. And this bill does just that. And women have lost significantly more jobs than men since the pandemic began. We have eviscerated more than 30 years of progress in the labor force in just 1 year. And this bill is going to go far into helping right that ship and recognize the dignity, respect that women's work needs and the value that women play in our economy. So whether, as Congresswoman Trahan said, it is getting vaccines in the arms to get our children safely back in school, whether it's the survivor checks, $1,400 payments that are going to help families hang on, an expanded child tax credit that is going to cut child poverty in half in this country. I mean, think of that. Cut child poverty in half. And, the list goes on with housing and food assistance, unemployment insurance. And one of my issues that I have been fighting for is dealing with child care. And this bill will not only stabilize child care, but help parents afford childcare and access it so they can get back to work. This is a historic bill in its proportion, in the solutions that it delivers, and in the path for the future that it sets forth, where the work of women is valued and we make sure that we are lifting all of our children up and giving them an opportunity. And this is sort of the work that you dream about being able to do in Congress. We come here to help people, and this bill is not only going to meet those, you know, those immediate challenges and the loss that people have faced, but it really puts a framework for a more just economy and for equal footing for women in it. And it's a tremendous accomplishment.
Congresswoman Trahan, in a minute, I am going to ask you guys a little bit about the size and the concerns around the bill. But before we do that, picking up on the path for the future that this sets forth, to use the words that Congresswoman Clark just used, is there a constituent or a constituent story that sticks in your mind that you feel like the provisions in this bill, especially provisions around unemployment supports for childcare businesses, the child credit expansion, et cetera, that you feel this kind of addresses? Can you put a human face on this for us?
Oh, well, I absolutely can. And I have countless stories. I mean, the last year has been hearing the personal stories of teachers, school administrators, municipal leaders who need the aid. But, you know, on Friday, I was at the Greater Lawrence Family Health Center, which is a teaching community health center on the front lines, has been on the front lines for the duration of this pandemic. But I got to walk into a clinic where they got their 2,000 federal doses in addition to, you know, the state allocation. And there were people in those chairs celebrating, right? These are folks in Lawrence, are, you know, one of our most underserved communities that have been waiting for, you know, to get their vaccination. And it was a celebration. I mean, it was emotional. You know, the head of the community health center and I, we both had tears in our eyes, you know, because this bill, it provides more than $20 billion to establish a national COVID vaccination program. And that money is already going to our community healthcare centers, who intimately understand that they have to close this disparity gap, that they have to get scrappy about going to where people are in their communities, to their churches, and they're doing that, and they're able to do that because of this plan and because of this administration. So, yes, I have so many stories that I've brought with me this entire year and have really influenced what we have fought for in this rescue package.
Congresswoman Clark, I'll start with you now to explore a little bit of the pushback. I mean, this is a massive spend. It's just under $2 trillion. NPR calculates that's equal to roughly 9% of the U.S. GDP. It is one of the biggest spending bills in American history. Shouldn't we be concerned about the size of this spend, even if one stipulates the benefits that you're laying out?
I think we have to listen to the economists, listen to the chorus of voices that are telling us the risk of overinvestment is very small, but the risk of underinvesting in American families at this time is very large. And so this bill, I think, meets the scale and the severity of this pandemic and how it has tattered our economy. And as I travel around my district and hear the stories of loss, of anxiety, of fear, I know that this bill is a lifeline. And that is exactly where we should be spending. Let's make those investments in the American people. It is not lost on me that this is the exact same amount as the tax bill that Republicans put forth in 2017, $1.9 trillion. $1 trillion is hard to get your head around, but this bill goes to helping Americans and American families. That bill was almost exclusively for the very wealthy. And so that's where our values have to be. We have to be making those investments that allow us to regain our health and our financial health and to address the scale of loss that we have seen, not only loss of life to this pandemic, but also loss of jobs and of the effects on our mental health and all of the revelations of this pandemic, of inequities that existed before but that have come to light. And this bill does so much to move us forward in this period of time where we are dealing with both a time of reckoning for racial and economic justice. And that's why I think the scale and the size of this bill, it meets this moment and puts us on a path so that we will be better prepared, more resilient, and have more equality in our economy moving forward.
Congresswoman Trahan, let's stay with this for just a second longer. There has been a criticism that I would paraphrase as this bill is too much too late. And what I mean by that is the economy, arguments that the economy is starting to rebound already, that there are real risks of inflation in this spending, although Congresswoman Clark did touch on that a little. What about this argument that it's too late in that we don't need this much because the economy is starting to gain its own steam?
Well, I will tell you the sequence has always been about getting through the public health crisis so that we can start to stimulate our economy. And that's what this package does. It accelerates us getting through. I mean, look, we have finally a national testing and vaccination plan with billions of dollars behind it. We know that we want to reopen our schools. I mean, part of the reason why we've lost so many women, so many mothers out of the workforce is because they've been juggling caring for their loved ones, helping with remote schooling, and had to leave to make ends meet during this pandemic. This is exactly the scale. And, you know, the assistant speaker said it best. There's not an economist, whether we're talking to Republicans or Democrats, that say that this is the scale that we have to pass a package like this so that we can have an economic recovery. It is going to, shave an entire year off our projected return to full employment. It's going to mitigate millions of jobs lost in this year alone. It'll help 2.3 million women who have been forced to leave the workforce entirely return to work. And so that is what's most important. And, you know, I do think that this is a tale of two parties with differing values, right? I think Congresswoman Clark was right to point out that comparable size package going to the wealthiest of Americans just a few years ago, when we're focused on getting our workers back to the help that they need to stay afloat during this pandemic, to make sure that our restaurants and our smallest of small businesses can stay open, to make sure that our families aren't in food lines for a day longer. And that is that's why this package is so important and it's so significant.
So I want to shift gears a little bit here and maybe have a little bit of fun with it as we do at the very beginning, Congresswoman Clark. You mentioned International Women's Day was yesterday. Women's History Month is this month. We are at a time with the highest percentage of women serving in Congress in history. Do the two of you feel it? Can you feel a difference? And what does that feel like?
Well, I'm happy to start. I think it feels a little weird to celebrate the fact that this is the most female Congress in our nation's history when you actually look at the numbers and see that it's still only 27% of seats in the House and Senate are held by women. Now, that's a huge improvement from the 13% a decade ago, but it also perfectly illustrates just how far we still have to go to ensure that women have the representation that we deserve when decisions are made. You know, I often say that I don't need to read another study to know that better decisions are made when more women are at the table. And, you know, even with this package, you can see the fingerprints of so many of our women leaders on this recovery plan, because it has investments in child care. It has investments in health care and reopening our schools. And, you know, we're going to quickly start to tackle workplace fairness and the gender pay gap and climate change. For me, reining in big tech so that our children are protected and their privacy is protected. I think that's what you get when you have more women at the table. And we still need many, many more if we're going to accelerate the change that we want to see.
How about you, Congresswoman Clark?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with Lori more. And let me tell you what a joy it is to have Lori and Ayanna Pressley in our delegation. And the priorities do change when women are at the leadership table. We bring a different perspective. We promote a different agenda. And I think that this bill is an excellent example of that. Keeping our eye on the needs of families and children and centering our work and priorities around that. And that's what women do. And I watch Lori balancing her career and the incredible work she's doing in Congress while also caring for her children and her young children. And that is the balance that takes place around this country. And understanding what it means to be caring for children and caring for aging parents. These are real life experiences. And as I sit in some of our committee rooms and I look around at the portraits of primarily white men who were former chairmen of those committees, and then I look to my left and right and see women and women of color and the incredible diversity that is the Democratic caucus in the House, and it looks like America. And when we have truly representative government that is not only representing women, but women of color and indigenous women, it makes a difference. Those priorities, life experiences, all inform our work and make for a stronger and better legislation and solutions for families at home. And so while we are in some ways the very worst of times and women are carrying such a load of loss and as caregivers of opportunities and choices and jobs, we are still, this bill gives me optimism as we come out of this, that we can tap this diversity, tap the women and the voices that they bring to our work here in Congress and make long-term changes. And I think that's why you said you heard such excitement in our voice over this legislation, because this is one of those opportunities to really transform how we value women, their experience, and their voices, and to codify it, and to say to the women in this country and across the Commonwealth that you matter, and we see you, and we value and honor you. And this bill does that. And it's not perfect. There is much more work to be done. But it is a really monumental start on that path to equity. And it's you can see it in our caucus that reflects back what our country looks like. And that is the strength. And we are going to continue to tap those experiences, tap the incredible women here in Congress, and use their voices, because those are the voices of the American people, to set the priorities here and to continue to deliver for American families.
So before we let you go, just one last question. I'll turn it to you, Congresswoman Trahan. 1 year ago today here on Radio Boston, we started our Ask the Doctors segments, and we're going to do one after the break. What question do you get most often or hear most often from your constituents about the virus and vaccinations?
Yeah, well, I think you know, I just did a PSA for a vaccine safety, right? We still have some reluctance out there. And so talking to folks about the safety of getting their vaccine is probably one of the questions that I get. But also, you know, other questions around, you know, what does it mean if I, how soon will I be effective after I take the vaccine? Will I still be able to pass it on to my loved ones? You know, so I think there are still questions that, you know, we're answering. And, you know, it reminds me of when I was at the health center on Friday, because those trusted providers are the ones who break through, and they can give that assurance to folks that this is the path forward. I mean, the CDC guidelines that were given yesterday that, you know, for those who are vaccinated, we will be able to be inside with our family and our loved ones and finally hug them without, you know, fear it's the light at the end of the tunnel that everyone's been waiting for. And so I think as much as we can educate folks about getting the vaccine as soon as they're able to do it, so that they can be with their family and their friends again, is what we have to be promoting.
Well, that's just been a great conversation. That was Congresswoman Lori Trahan of Massachusetts 3rd District and Assistant House Speaker Catherine Clark of Massachusetts 5th District. During this Women's History Month, a joy to have the two of you together. Thanks so much for being on Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much.
We just heard before the break that Congress is poised to send a $1.9 trillion COVID stimulus package to President Biden's desk this week. It's a bill that would continue unemployment benefits, offer more support for getting vaccines into arms. That comes after yesterday when the Centers for Disease Control announced new guidelines for fully vaccinated people. They can gather privately, indoors, without masks and without physical distancing. That's as more than 700,000 Massachusetts residents qualify as fully vaccinated. So lots of questions there, and we find ourselves wondering, is it time? Are we beginning, just starting, to head back to normal? And what does normal look like? What's safe? So we've got questions, and we know you do too. Let's ask the doctors. Call with your questions about the vaccine, the rollout, the reopening. What do you still need to know? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now is Dr. Joshua Barocas, an infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center and assistant professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine, and Dr. Benjamin Linus, also an infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center and associate professor of medicine and epidemiology at the Boston University School of Medicine. Doctors Barocas, Linus, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks so much.
So I want to dive right in. You may have heard, I don't know if you were with us yet, when we heard Congresswoman Lori Trahan just before the break talk about some of the confusion around what vaccines really mean for people. And I wanted to start actually by playing a little sound for you to that end. This is CDC Director Rochelle Walensky, formerly of MGH, also used to be a regular on these Ask the Doctor segments for us. And she's explaining the new CDC guidelines for vaccinated Americans. Here she is.
Fully vaccinated people can visit with unvaccinated people from one other household indoors without wearing masks or physical distancing, as long as the unvaccinated people and any unvaccinated members of their household are not at high risk for severe COVID-19 disease. When fully vaccinated people are visiting with unvaccinated people from multiple households, everyone should wear masks and physically distance and meet outdoors.
Okay, so it feels like the two factors at play there, three factors, who's vaccinated and who's not, who's high risk and who's not, and how many families are we talking about? Can you kind of smooth that out for us, Dr. Linus, and sort of explain a little more simply, if possible, who gets to do what when once they're vaccinated?
Sure, happy to. So I think the general idea behind this new guidance is to recognize that we are beginning to enter the post-vaccine world and that there should be some good things that come from that. And one of the early things that we can begin to enjoy is seeing friends and family and loved ones again. And so the general gist is if everybody is fully vaccinated, then you can get together in private settings and enjoy life the way that you did before COVID. It's fine for people to be having dinner parties in a private setting, small groups, as long as everyone is vaccinated. It's also okay for example, the grandparents to come over, even if the kids haven't been vaccinated yet, right? I think that's the sort of situation that they're trying to describe, and the idea that if one person has been vaccinated and not everyone in the house has, if it's a small group, a personal setting, that could be safe. And what we're trying to avoid is group gatherings, large group gatherings where many people are not unvaccinated, where many people have not yet been vaccinated. In that situation, then we still need to be wearing masks and distancing. So I think this is the right guidance, that now is the time that it's appropriate to start testing the waters again with close friends and family and start to sort of recoup some of those losses of personal relation that we've all experienced for a year now.
So, Dr. Barocas, the calls are pouring in already, and I do want to go to them in just a minute. But building on what Dr. Linus just explained and going back to that question that Congresswoman Trahan said she heard from her constituents, there seems to be a little confusion remaining about how at risk one is personally when one has been vaccinated. Can you still carry it? Can you still get sick? Can you still give it to others? And I understand there's a little bit of nuance to that answer, I think. Can you lay that out for us?
Yeah. So the simplest way that I think about it is the vaccines that we have are incredibly good at preventing disease. And the infection, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, causes infection, and the infection can cause disease. Disease is a syndrome, is a bunch of different symptoms that you can have. Everything from, you know, a cough and sore throat to, of course, being febrile and needing hospitalization. The vaccines that we have are really, really, really good at preventing severe disease, including those that require hospitalization and the extent that can kill you. So death, hospitalization and death. They're also very good at preventing mild, moderate, and severe disease. It doesn't mean, however, that it 100% protects you from that. And it also doesn't mean that it 100% protects you from getting the infection. The goal, however, is if you get the infection, it lessens your symptoms. It lessens the amount of disease that you actually have. So maybe you're just asymptomatic. Maybe you just have some sniffles. As opposed to being unvaccinated, you have a higher likelihood of that severe disease. Does that help?
It does. Thank you. And I think it's time to just go to the phones. Let's jump in. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your coronavirus vaccine safety questions. We've got Jeff on the line from Andover. Jeff, go ahead.
Hi there. I've got a question just about the dynamic with two school-aged children, one vaccinated parent and one unvaccinated parent. And with all the chatter going on about pushing kids back into school, I understand that kids are at a lower risk for complications from the virus. But what does that do to parents in a household where we may have one or possibly both parents unvaccinated? I feel like there's a high, high risk factor there for the children to transmit to the parents. And I'd like a little more info on that.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. Dr. Linus, can you help Jeff with any of that?
Yeah, I can. This is actually a really important question that everyone has been wondering for the better part of a year now. But fortunately, I think that we now have the experience and the data to answer it fairly well. And it's a real concern. There was a study that just came out in a preprint from some colleagues at Hopkins that looked at this very thing at a very high level with over 500,000 people in the study. And they found that families that had kids who were in school were at higher risk of having infection in the family, but that also when the schools put mitigation into place, all of that extra risk could be mitigated away, or effectively all of it.
What do you mean by mitigation?
So when in schools where people are masking, where there is social distancing of at least 3 feet going on, that then as more and more of those measures are put into place in the schools, that risk of having infection in the family went down to almost zero. And so really, I think the takeaway message from that piece was schools are a place where there can be COVID transmission. And if we're in denial about COVID in school, it's possible that COVID comes home and does infect people in the house. but that fortunately, if we don't live in denial, we mask, we social distance, we make some basic interventions on air exchange, it's possible to decrease that risk so that you can be safe at home even when your kids are in school. And I think that's the take-home message right now and why so many scientists are coming to the consensus that it's time to go back into schools, because we see the risk is there, but the risk is addressable through the basic mitigation measures that we've been putting in place all year.
Thanks, Dr. Linus. Let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255. Bill in Cambridge. Bill, what's your question?
I want to know how long does the vaccination last? Are we going to have to get booster shots in another 6 months?
Dr. Barocas, do we know?
Good question. We don't know yet, mostly because we don't have 6 months worth of data yet. You know, most vaccines that we get have somewhere on the order of years to lifetime protection. We know very, very little about the long-term sustainability of this virus, of this vaccine. So far, we have data from a number of clinical trials, and that those data keep getting updated with every passing month. So the short and the long answer is we don't know. I think many of us in the scientific community are optimistic about at least some long-term protection from this vaccine, from these vaccines. But it's very possible that we'll need a booster, or if there are changes to that are beyond the variants that we've seen so far, that we'll need a different vaccine. That's down the road. Right now, I think the biggest take home is that we have a number of safe and effective vaccines that when you're ready, when you're able, you should get.
Terrific. Let's go back to the phones. Beth in Billerica. Beth, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. We had trouble getting my mother in for a vaccination, but we finally got her into Foxborough 4 weeks ago, and she got the Moderna. And they said to make an appointment for, you know, the 4 weeks. We were unable to do that. We've been unable to do that. We've tried online. We've tried on the phone. So my mom is pretty disgusted at this point. She said, well, maybe I'll just stay with the one dose. How effective do you think that's going to be?
Thanks for that. And Beth, just to clarify, this was at Gillette, at one of the mass vaccination sites at Gillette Stadium?
Yeah, I can't get her in. Okay. They keep giving me different information. First, it's online. They tell me to call back one day. And they say, oh, no, you should have called back the other day. Well, I've been trying for 2 weeks. I can't get her in.
Thanks, Beth. And I'm sorry for that frustration. That sounds very frustrating. Dr. Linus, let's have you answer that one.
Sure. Yeah, that is frustrating. I'm so sorry you're experiencing that. I wish I had good information to how to fix that problem other than to keep on calling. But I can give you information about the one dose, two dose. So we do have that knowledge now in both I believe it's the Pfizer and the Moderna data. The first dose of the vaccine after 2 weeks is about 85% effective in blocking COVID, which is good. But I still think it's important to go get that second dose for two reasons. One, it adds even a little bit more efficacy. And second, the type of antibody that you develop after the second dose, the booster dose of the vaccine, is actually different than what you get with the first dose. And it might be more durable, meaning longer lasting. So there's every reason to go for the second dose. It's not just more of the same, right? It's actually taking it to the next level and a better form of immunity. And I think it's definitely worth it to keep at it. I'm sure it's maddening. And I wouldn't worry too much about the fact that the time is ticking. It's not as if the first dose is going to go away sometime in the next couple of weeks. You have the time to go get the second dose, but I think I would spend the time to keep doing that.
And Beth, our producer, Jamie Bologna, suggests, if you haven't done this already, that using the 211 line at the state level to speak with folks there who might be able to help you with this might be another option. I'd like to go back to the phones here because they just keep coming. 800-423-8255. We'll take one more call and then we'll go to a break. Alan in Dorchester. Alan, what's your question?
Hi. I was wondering if there's any thoughts on if there's any effectiveness with the vaccine against the long haul effects that some people are getting after being infected with COVID?
Thanks for that question. Dr. Barocas, can you help Alan with that?
So sure, Alan. So the if I understand the question correctly, I think that there might be two questions hidden in there. First is, if you currently are someone with long COVID, does the vaccine somehow help with the symptoms that maybe one is still experiencing? And the answer right now is no. This is, of course, this prevents you from having new infection. I have gotten the question, and maybe this is also embedded in there, should people who have long COVID, who still have symptoms, get the vaccine, even though they're still symptomatic? And the answer to that is yes. We still don't know a ton about why people are experiencing longer duration of symptoms, but we know that those individuals aren't necessarily infectious. They don't have the active infection that's going to make you pass it on to somebody else. It's a long-term sort of sequelae of the infection. And so if you are somebody that's having long COVID symptoms, then I would still encourage you to get the vaccine, but knowing that it's not necessarily going to shorten the duration of your symptoms.
Ask the Doctors on Radio Boston, 1 year into doing Ask the Doctors, and the information is still so valuable. So call with your coronavirus questions, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Guiding us today through this ever-changing landscape is Dr. Joshua Barocas, an infectious diseases physician at Boston Medical Center and an assistant professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine, and Dr. Benjamin Linus, also an infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center and associate professor of medicine and epidemiology at the Boston University School of Medicine. Thank you for staying with us, Drs. Barocas and Linus. The phones are just keep going. So are you guys okay with, we just jump back in with calls?
Absolutely.
Fine. All right, let's do it. So 800-423-8255. Rita is on the line in Cape Cod. Rita, go ahead.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I've heard three doctors say that people with medical allergies should not take the vaccine for now. One was a UK doctor, one US doctor on TV, and one US doctor on radio. I have many medical allergies, penicillin, simvastatin. I'm also a diabetic. Any comment on this would be appreciated.
Thanks for that call. Thanks, Rita. Dr. Benjamin Linus. Sorry, yes, Dr. Benjamin Linus, go ahead.
Yeah, sure, that's fine. Sure, Rita. No, I understand the concern. I want to be a little bit careful. I don't want to give you direct medical advice, and I definitely suggest that you speak to your own physician. But I can tell you the concern with allergy around the COVID vaccine, the question we ask when giving the vaccine is, have you ever had a severe allergy to a vaccine? So I think that some of the allergies you describe, like a penicillin allergy, would not dissuade me from giving vaccine. But there is some concern. If you've had what's called anaphylaxis, which is difficulty breathing and swelling of your throat to a vaccine in the past, then there might be some reason to be concerned, and we'd want to be careful about that. But I would definitely not just write yourself off from vaccination based on a general history of allergies and seek specific advice from your doctor.
800-423-8255. We've got Michael on the line from Beverly. Michael, what's your question?
Hi, thank you. I think my question might sound a little silly, but I have a debilitating fear of needles, especially since they take it out of your arm when you're getting your blood drawn. Can the shot be administered anywhere else in the body,
Michael,
like on your leg?
Oh, my heart goes out to you, Michael. Yeah, my heart goes out to you. Dr. Barocas, could Michael get it somewhere other than in the arm?
Yeah, the short answer is yes, you can get it somewhere other than your arm. The only other place that I've seen it administered is in the buttock, which is a possibility. And I do understand it. The people who I have vaccinated have said actually that it is not a painful injection, even in the arm. I don't know why, but they said that it's less painful than others. But yes, you can get it in your backside.
So doctors, there's a question that I want to ask you. It hasn't come through from our callers yet, but it's very much on my mind as we have these conversations with vaccine developers and infectious disease specialists, et cetera. We hear sets of data that suggest that the various vaccines that are available now, Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, have different efficacy rates under different contexts. We also consistently hear, and understandably so, they are all good. Do not vaccine shop. Just get vaccinated, whichever one comes your way. I understand both of those things. But how do we think about the differentiation in data that we are hearing about how these vaccines come out of clinical trials? And should that matter to folks?
It's a tough question. Ben, do you want to take that?
Sure, happy to. I think it's a fantastic question. And I think what's one thing that's really interesting about it is that these are the types of questions that clinical trialists and doctors ask all the time before COVID. Things come out of clinical trials, and there's questions about head-to-head comparison between medicines constantly. It's just that generally it's not quite as public a discussion as it is now. So the idea of trying to understand how to put two things head-to-head against each other when they were never actually placed, right, or trialed or competed against each other in a head-to-head manner is something that's common in the field of clinical medicine. And I think the reality is that you can't actually do that. It's not really valid to hold two separate clinical trials next to each other and take that what we call that point estimate of efficacy, the 95% protection versus 85% protection, and say that one is better than the other. Because they were done in entirely different populations at different time points and with different viruses in circulation, and you don't really know what each vaccine would have done had it been in the other vaccine's population, if that makes sense. And so really what we know about the vaccines now is, as Josh was saying before, if you get the vaccine, you're not going to die from COVID, you're not going to go to the hospital from COVID, you're not going to get very sick from COVID. We also know that all of the vaccines block transmission somewhat. We just don't know how much. And we don't know the comparative effectiveness of those things blocking transmission. But we do know they all keep people alive and keep people well, that they all block transmission somewhat, and also that they don't need to block transmission perfectly in order to help us end this epidemic. If everybody got a vaccine that was even 50% effective at blocking viral transmission, so the passing of the virus, we likely would be able to stamp out this epidemic. We're not dependent on a perfectly effective vaccine for all transmission to end this. So I think whatever vaccine comes your way, take that. They all have their ups and downs. And don't avoid that pitfall of holding them up next to each other, because they were never intended to be interpreted. The data was never intended to be interpreted that way.
Thank you for that. Dr. Berkowitz, before I go back to calls, and there are more, is there anything you want to add to that?
You know, Ben is a lot more eloquent than I am on this topic, but I will say that the easiest way to think about it is if I ask my patients to ask themselves the question, why am I getting this vaccine? The goal, and most people say, I'm getting this vaccine to stay out of the hospital and to avoid dying from COVID. And if that's your goal, which I think it's pretty much everybody's goal at this point, then they are, even though we're not supposed to compare them, as Ben said, they all do that equally well.
Thank you for that. 800-423-8255. We've got Dan on the line in Rockland. Dan, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am very eager to get the vaccine. As an essential worker that sees a lot of the public every day. I'm also a Guillain-Barré survivor, and I know a few months back that Dr. Fauci had given some guidance to kind of wait and see whether there was a correlation between Guillain-Barré and the vaccine being a trigger. Is there any new advice, new guidance on that?
Thanks for that question. I do want to underscore, I'm hearing from the studio that we actually had multiple callers with that same question, and also just in general about being immunocompromised and taking the vaccine. So obviously this is something that's on people's mind. Thanks for raising it, Dan. Dr. Linus?
I am not aware of new data on Guillain-Barré. There are vaccines that can trigger Guillain-Barré, and I don't know if your past history was related to vaccination, but that is a known side effect, not just to COVID vaccination, of all vaccines occasionally. And so there is some concern there, and again, I would advise talking to your personal physician to make your personal decision. The immune suppression one I find easier. In fact, I just was speaking to my cousin yesterday who asked me this question. You know, if you're on an partially immune suppressive agent, like something for rheumatoid arthritis or something like that, there's no risk from these vaccines. And so there, I think you're okay. But I think the Guillain-Barré question is a real one, and it's a hard one. It takes time to find those effects. and it really just comes down to a risk-benefit decision.
Let's see if we can get, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to add, there is information on the CDC website, and looking through the clinical trial data recently, there were no, just so everyone knows, there were no cases of Guillain-Barré that had been reported following vaccination in either of the mRNA trials, and only one was reported in the Johnson & Johnson trial. So this is obviously an emerging area, but as Ben said, it's something that we should have individualized conversations about, but they are safe even for people with a history of Guillain-Barré.
I'd like to try to get at least one more question. We've got Lauren on the line in Watertown. Lauren, go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering, for women who are trying to become pregnant, and should they go ahead and get the vaccine, or should they wait and see what happens and maybe wait till their second trimester?
Thanks for the question, Lauren. Dr. Barocas, I'll come back to you.
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, first and foremost, people who are pregnant, women who are pregnant, are at increased risk for severe illness from COVID-19. So that's the, I want to set the stage that way and say that we want to make sure that we're protecting pregnant women from any way we can from COVID. There are limited data about the safety of the COVID vaccine for people who are pregnant. However, most people in the medical profession and the scientific community at this point are actually encouraging people at least to have the conversation with their physician or their provider about receiving the vaccine. So in my opinion, I would say talk with your provider, knowing that the safety data are forthcoming. But most medical societies, including those that treat pregnant women, are very positive toward the vaccine.
Dr. Linus, we don't have time for any more calls, but I am going to sneak in a caller question. Anne from Fenway essentially wanted to know, how long after one receives a shot, if one is going to have side effects from the shot, would one see those side effects? Just briefly.
Sure. Generally, the side effects start around 12 hours and last between 24 and 36 hours, maybe 2 days, but a day or two.
Great. That was so brief that we could do one more thing. Dr. Barocas, last thought for all of our callers. Just again, briefly, just last thought.
Last thought is when you are able, please, please, please go get the vaccine. I know that there are distribution issues. I know that there are a number of issues, but this is our best chance at going back to some sense of normalcy.
Dr. Joshua Barocas, infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center. Dr. Benjamin Linus, infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center. So great to have you both back. Thank you for doing Ask the Doctors.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Withman, with help from Stephen Gelman. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for all the calls. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.